Insert disc 2.
Retro Gaming Radio, 2006. A different hobby than sitting with your ass strapped up to Xbox Live. God, I love Generation Gaming. This is retarded. Why am I reading this list?
Hey, that's Pikachu.
Keep it retro. Hello, folks. Welcome to the March 2006 edition of Retro Gaming Radio. This is Shane Armonroe, your host. Welcome to the program. Well, as always, the show is running a little bit late, but I think you'll find it was worth the wait. This month, we interview the masters behind Intellivision, Keith Robinson. You know, the guy that runs around in the little Burger Time chef outfit when you see him at shows? That's the guy, and he's going to tell us all about good stuff, including the forthcoming DS version of Intellivision Lives. This will be the first time you ever get to play an Intellivision game properly emulated, including buttons and everything else. It's going to be really cool. We also have an editorial commentary on digital distribution and how it's going to affect you as the classic gamer. We have huge bits and bytes, updates on our DVD packages, tons more right here on Retro Gaming Radio. This month's editorial commentary is going to be fairly short. I wanted to comment on something that's been kind of bugging the crap out of me, and that's digital distribution. I know you're thinking, digital distribution, what does that have to do with classic gaming? But it has a lot to do with classic gaming. For a long time, we've all been, well, a lot of us who have been around since the early MAME days are dying to come up with a methodology of legally playing these classic games. And I've said time and time again, I'm sure Flair could helpfully point out where on the show I've mentioned it before, but there's a mantra that we would like to see in this legalized way of playing classic gaming. You know, we want to be able to download ROMs right off the web. We want to be able to play them in whatever emulator we choose to play them in. We'd like to be able to put them on a CD and move them to another computer. We would like the ability to play the original game. We don't want to see how you've reinvented the graphics and reinvented the gameplay. We want the original game in the original format running on whatever emulator we choose, and we don't want to pay more than about a buck a hit for it. That's not a hard goal to meet. But in today's super scary, you know, digital rights management and copyright worries and IP battles, it's never going to happen. Now, frankly, what I would rather see, other than this new digital content distribution crap that's going on, I would much rather see it stay gray. I know this is hard to believe, but I would rather see all support, commercial support for retro gaming or classic gaming to go away. I would rather see that go away and have everybody laying off the small ROM sites, the legally gray places where you get ROM images, things like that. Because at least that way we're getting what we want. I mean, obviously we're not paying anybody. You know, I would happily hand a buck over to the guy that made Centipede, or the woman who made Centipede. I would gladly hand over a buck right now to Ed Rotberg. In fact, I should throw him a buck next time I see him. Say, thank you for Battlezone. Here, I'm playing the ROM at home. Here's a buck. It's more than you're going to see from Apple iTunes or iGames or whatever they come up with when they start shoveling some Battlezone-ish game down to the iPod. They're not going to see that money. That, in fact, that's what I want to see. I'd like to see websites that directly relate to the original game developers. The Ed Rotbergs, the David Cranes, the Gary Kitchens, the Don Bluth. Rick Dyer. That's better. Don Bluth's an animator. Brilliant animator, but he's the animator. Rick Dyer made the video game. So I would like to actually see a website where I could go up and say, thank you for Battlezone. Here's a buck. And then I'll go home and play my legally gray ROMs, because that's the only way I'm going to get to play the damn thing. I don't get to play it on a legal pack, because the legal packs have like 10 games you've already played before. I'm not going to get to play them on some digital distribution system like Xbox Live, because they're going to stretch and roll it out to high res, or they're going to make it network playable, so I don't have to have a guy flapping joust next to me. I want the original game in the original format. If I want a second player, I'll haul somebody's ass over in front of my TV. I want to be able to play the games the way that they were originally made. I don't want you to fix the pterodactyl bug in Joust. I want that there. I want to be able to play Warlords with a spinner control. You want to help me out? Build me a spinner and sell it. Sell me a USB-based spinner for $4.99. That's how you can help me out. Don't tell me you're going to help me out by making a back catalog of 500 games available that I can't save, I can't play anywhere but on your system while I'm connected online, holding my finger up my ass the whole time. I don't want to worry if my content's going to expire in a week and I need to re-up my account. I don't need to have a phone home check when I want to play Atari ET. That's not the way this is supposed to work, folks. This must be, you know, I never understood why people bitched so much about Ted Turner coming along and colorizing the classics. I thought, you know, that's kind of gay. I mean, why are you guys in such big arms about that? I mean, they were crappy old movies to begin with, right? There you go. Generation Gimme at Work, just in a different location. These are crappy old movies to begin with. And now you're colorizing them, because I actually won't flip past a color movie on the TV. If I'm flipping through the channels, I'll admit it. I'm a prude. If I'm flipping through the channels on the TV and I see something that's black and white, I skip right over it. I don't care what it is. If it's black and white, I'm gone. Move. So I'm a prude in my own ways. But I understand now. I don't want people monkeying with that stuff. And when you take away the concept of throwing a cartridge in a machine and turning it on, right? You don't need to have broadband required, must have Xbox Live account, must set this up, must set that up, you know, modified to fit your screen. It all drives me bonkers. And trust me, folks, the digital distribution thing, I don't care who's providing it. If it's not done right, I'm going to scream at Nintendo for it with the Revolution. I'm going to scream at Xbox Live. I'm going to scream at everybody for screwing up what is a very simple formula. The people who really care about classic games are going to do it the way they want to, whether there's a legal means to do it or not. If you want to cash in on those people, these people aren't going to pay you to play Pac-Man. They've got the ROM sitting on their machine right now. What they want is a way to compensate the developer. They want a way to say, yeah, I've got Pac-Man, and I didn't steal it. Find us a way to clear our conscience. Don't find a way to lock down our machine. Don't find a way to require us to have product activation for, you know, Asteroids Deluxe. Give us a means of paying that doesn't piss us off. iTunes pisses me off. You know? If I'm going to pay somebody, I would rather go out and buy the CD so that I can rip it into a format that I want than to go to iTunes and buy it. Why? Because they've pissed me off. I always said a dollar download for MP3s would be paradise. You know what? iTunes is not paradise. Their client's not paradise. Big bloated bastard. Their connectivity with the iPod's not paradise. And certainly, not being able to do anything with it. I have to burn it to a CD, re-rip it myself. You know what? It's too much work. Digital distribution, while it may sound great, and there are some facets of it that'd be okay if they didn't poke the pooch on it. But I guarantee you, poking the pooch is exactly what they're going to do with it. We've already seen it. iTunes is a prime example of it. I want downloadable MP3s for a buck a hit. If you want to see the right way to do it, and this is a legally gray site, so I take no responsibility for what you do, but if you go to allofmp3.com, that website epitomizes exactly what I want to see with digital delivery. Did you know that at allofmp3.com, when you go find an album, you find a song that you want, you pay for it, they actually offer you different formats. Yeah. You can choose whether you want FLAC, MP3, WMA. You can choose whether you want variable or constant bitrate encoding. That's choice. That's a freedom. That's availability. I can get exactly what I want
I'd pay more for it. I mean, it's one of those, I think, Russian sites where everything's like a dime, you know, so like they're violating some copyright law somewhere. But if iTunes or somebody could come along and say, here, we're going to give you content. We're going to give you Asteroids Deluxe. We're going to give you Zookeeper, not the DS game, but the original arcade game. We're going to give you Zookeeper. We're going to let you move it wherever you feel like it. We're going to let you play it with whatever player you want, that as long as it conforms to, you know, our basic format. You know, these are raw ROM dumps, whatever. Right? They can work with the community. If MAME supports it, you're good to go. From that, everybody else will fall into suit. Right? It's a PTK file. Right? It's a PTK file. It has all the original ROM images and is using an LZW compression, whatever. Right? Everything starts using it. There's no encryption. There's no keys. There's no call phoning home. There's no encrypting it to my machine ID. There's no requiring that my machine configuration doesn't change between the times I want to play ET versus Frogger. It's insane. They're asking us to jump through an unreasonable amount of hoops. Make it seamless, at least. You know? There are ways to do this. The people that are going to steal from you, I want anybody who works for iTunes, anybody who works for Microsoft that's listening to me, listen very carefully. The people that are going to steal from you are going to do it whether or not you overprotect your content or not. If you release Sony, if you release a CD that's copy protected, that I can't make a rip of it, rootkit, Sony, if you're going to do something like that, I'm going to go to allofmp3.com and download it for a dime. Right? That's what's going to happen. That's what people are going to say to you. You have made it hard for me. Why do you think file sharing is so popular? Do you really think that people want to go out and steal? Do you think that everybody is really inherently evil and, you know, when given a choice between a reasonable fair price product and one for free, they will always move to free? Well, okay, maybe that is kind of representative. Talk myself into a corner on that one, right? No, but seriously, if you give people a reasonable alternative, you're going to see revenue increase. All you do by overprotecting this stuff, and this is just the old copyright discussion over and over again, make it reasonable. Stop spending so much money on your copy protection and start working on the quality of your product. You know, I've seen reasonable consumer copy protection in place. Right? I've seen some reasonable stuff. The fact of the matter is, folks, no matter how you look at it, if you piss us off, if you provide us with substandard emulation packages, if you provide us with non-original games, and if you try to whore the name of Joust or Robotron, whatever you do, we're going to find another way to play these games. It's not that hard, dude. We got Google. We can find stuff. Right? Why not, instead of fighting the power, why not instead of making everything so damn complicated? But see, that's what makes iTunes so evil. It's complicated, but they do it in such a method where nobody realizes until they need a departure from spec that they're being screwed with, right? You get an iPod, you got iTunes, you're paying 99 cents and it plays on what you want. Well, then all of a sudden it's like, well, hey, you know, I got this MP3 player in my car. How do I get my music onto that? Well, I can burn it to a CD. But if I want like MP3s though, I want to put like 12 hours of music on a disc instead of like 70 minutes of music on a disc. Well, holy crap, I can't do that with iTunes. I can burn it. I can burn an audio disc, but I can't play the files separate. Well, you know what the solution is? Plug your iPod into your stereo. Well, that's not the solution. You're not adding choice to us. You're taking it away, right? You don't go out and buy a car stereo that happens to have MP3 playback if you're going to drag your iPod with you everywhere. Which is really funny to me, because the people I see drag their iPods everywhere don't actually listen to them. It's like an accessory, like a watch or a brooch. They just have it with them. It's like, I don't know. Anyway, suffice to say, to wrap all of this up, now that I've got myself in a heated fervor here, digital distribution is not the savior of classic gaming like they're all trying to portray. Nintendo would have you believe they're the saviors of classic gaming. Xbox Live is trying to tell you that they're the saviors of classic and independent gaming. Right? Who played Hamster Ball after I reviewed it? Now, who's playing it on the Xbox Live? Who's playing, you know, who has already played Mutant Storm already on the PC? And now they're playing it on Xbox Live. Why? Because it can upscale to 1080p? Or 1080i or whatever the hell it is. I can't keep track, dude. I cannot keep track of the techno babble that comes out of early adopter type stuff, you know? Maybe someday I'll have all this, you know, 10 grand worth of video equipment and I can actually care if 1080i or 480p graphics come out of, Yar's Revenge. Maybe when I have a widescreen, high def TV with 7.1 EXTH certified surround sound, I'll care if Yar's Revenge has been upsampled to 1080i. Probably not, but maybe. What I'm saying is, digital distribution sounds like a good idea. Well, we're going to give you everything you want really easy, but that's not the way it's going to work out. I've got a GP2X sitting here right next to me. When I go and buy Donkey Kong from Nintendo via the Revolution to play, I can't put Donkey Kong on my GP2X. It's capable. It's got MAME. But I'm not going to be able to legally play Donkey Kong on my GP2X because that damn file is going to be encoded to my copy. I'm not even going to be able to move that Revolution game to another Revolution. It's probably going to be locked down by a machine MAC address or something goofy like that. It's getting out of hand, folks. And if we do not take a stand now to stop it, advertising in video games, what did I say about that like 2 years ago? If we didn't stop it, it was going to get out of line. It's getting out of line. Even now. What's funny is some people don't think it's out of line. Some people don't think that every 8 sentences that are spoken by the in-game player is an ad for a car dealership, for a fast food chain. That scares me. That scares me that people don't find anything wrong with this sort of thing. Did you guys see the article I posted last month, with the Subway ad in the middle of this dark, dank, like, underworld setting? You know, it's... advertising, by nature, is designed for you to see it. If it blends in seamlessly to the game, you're not going to see it. That totally negates what the purpose of advertising is, which is to get your attention. I don't want to be, you know, running away from a lichen, getting ready to get my guts torn out in the middle of a video game, and be looking at some Subway sign on the side of the wall. Help me out here. I don't know. Digital distribution, all of these things tying into a central core is like right out of the Bible Armageddon type stuff, the apocalypse, right? The human encoding, the 666 mark in the forehead. I know it seems kind of creepy, but, you know, it's getting to the point to where everything's going to be connected with everything. You know, you're not going to have any rights at all. You'll own nothing. It's already starting to be that way. I want to take my Beatles White Album out of the case every now and then and put it on the turntable, man. I want to be able to take the Beatles White Album over to my friend's house. I want to be able to play my CD on whatever frickin' hardware I want to play it on. Is that so complicated? I want to pay for stuff. Listen to me. Companies, you know, corporations, I want to pay. I want to give you my money. But I'm not going to give you my money to have you remove the rights from anything that I get from you. It's not going to work out that way. And eventually people are going to see it. Maybe not. Maybe the human race is going to roll over and take it up the tailpipe. I hope not. I hope that I'm wrong. I'm hoping that Nintendo doesn't poke the pooch, because they're going to drop a lot of respect points if the Revolution does not properly handle these virtual consoles or these back catalogs. I'm going to be watching close. And don't think I won't turn and attack Nintendo the second they step out of line, because I'll do it. I do bash Microsoft, but I will turn tails on Nintendo if they screw it up. And I know they're going to. There's no way they can get away without doing it. So anyway. So what do you guys think about digital distribution? There's tons of threads of it already going on MonroeWorld.com, our forums. I'd be curious to see what you guys think. Do you guys care? Do you guys care that our rights are being trampled? Do you care that you'll never own anything? Everything's virtual. There's no boxes. There's no CDs. Everything is tied to some key on the internet. Nothing can be taken offline. Everything works because it has to be online. I don't know about you guys, but when I have an internet outage, my life already sucks. If I can't watch TV, play music, or play video games because my internet connection's down, I'm gonna start slaughtering people. It's just going to be the way it is. Something to think about. Well, that's going to wrap it up for this editorial commentary. Join us next month when we'll take a look at something else that probably pisses me off right here on Retro Gaming Radio. This is Shane Monroe with Retro Gaming Radio. I'm on the phone with Brian Demolition Man Little. What's your question?
My question is, with all the talk Nintendo's doing with the Revolution, what kind of stuff would you like to see that Nintendo hasn't announced yet?
What would I like to see in the Revolution that Nintendo has not yet announced? Well, obviously, I'd like to see a lot of focus on the classics. I'd like to see the Virtual Console done right. And while we've had some early indications of what the Virtual Console is going to be in terms of being able to play classic first-party titles, some Sega, some TurboGrafx-16 stuff, I'd really like to see them make it portable. I'd like to see them be able to move emulation code between the Virtual Console and the DS. I'd like to be able to use the Revolution as a gateway. I'd like to sit back on my chair with the Nintendo DS, hit the Virtual Console, pull down Street Fighter 2 or Mortal Kombat or some other game that's, you know, one of the companies they're supporting. Let's say Super Smash Brothers. I'd like to be able to pull down the local code to my DS as player one, have somebody else in the room or across the sea throwing up their DS, hitting the Virtual Console and pulling down Super Smash Brothers, and between the two of us across the Revolution on our DS, being able to throw down a game right through the Revolution as the conduit. I think that would be incredible if the Virtual Console could extend to the DS. Sort of like a download relay station, your Revolution would allow you to transmit games right over to your DS. I think that would be probably the coolest thing ever, and it would be a definite sure lock sale for me on the Revolution.
Well, my fear is, to be honest, is with all this talk about advertising being added to games, what I'm afraid of seeing is Nintendo basically ganging it up and adding stuff like ads to classic games. Like, example, playing Super Mario Brothers, and now you're seeing ads for, say, Diet Pepsi being added into the game.
Yeah, and I definitely sympathize with the concept. The only good thing we have is Iwata said flat out that, you know, advertising isn't really where money is. And that didn't sound like that they were real hip on the concept over at Nintendo, even though he's like, you know, options are always open. But it doesn't sound like they're really going to move that direction. I hope that's the case, because I'd be really disappointed to see it going that way. I'm hoping in-game advertising itself just collapses upon itself. And you'd think that, you know, with the uprising that TiVo owners are having with ads being placed while they're fast-forwarding through ads, you'd think that the lunacy would come to a head and people would finally just say, knock it off, we're not going to play this game. But then you've got other people, you know, representative in our forums right now that say, you know, who cares if every eighth announcement in Fight Night 3 is an advertisement? We don't care. As long as the guy sweats realistic pools of sweat and his shirt's soaking wet while he fights, we don't care if they're pumping Burger King chicken fries at us. I don't know. I mean, it's all a matter of what the market will bear, and I'm starting to fear that the market's going to bear a lot. Let's hope Nintendo doesn't latch onto that.
And the thing is, you know, it seems like nowadays some of the massive corporations just don't seem to care one way or the other what they're forcing down people's throats. I mean, look at some of the movies that are coming out, like iRobot, which was like a glorified ad for how many products again. Did anybody keep track of this offhand?
I don't know, but I saw The Island, and that was like Microsoft. I mean, Microsoft must have like given half the funding to that movie. MSN Search was on phone booths. There was all sorts of Microsoft branding, Xbox branding all over the movie. That is not subtle advertisement by any means.
Well, heck, look at Crazy Taxi. I mean, you have Taco Bell, you have KFC, you have all these other companies basically getting free advertisement in the game.
Yeah, those are all PepsiCo companies. A lot of people didn't realize that, but every destination you see in Crazy Taxi is actually part of PepsiCo. KFC, Taco Bell, all those companies. I believe, if I remember right, as I was playing Crazy Taxi, I was thinking, hey, these are all PepsiCo games. But you know, it seems to be different to me to have a little window pop up and say, you know, Pizza Hut's your next destination, then it closes. You know, instead of, you know, being in a World War II scenario and a subway ad appears on the side of a building, it just seems to be, I don't know, a little bit different to me.
Yeah, the last thing I want to see while I'm trying to shoot down Nazis is Jared popping up on the screen going, ooh, we got a roasted chicken sandwich on sale this week before he died.
What really scares the crap out of me is that those bastards will be able to actually go in and change those at their own whim. So actually ad companies have direct control over your game. And I'm telling you, it's a recipe for disaster, but we'll see what happens. Is that answer your question, Brian Demo Man Little?
Yes, it does.
All right. Thank you for calling Retro Gaming Radio.
Not a problem.
Just our quick monthly plug of the Retro Gaming Radio edition DVD-ROMs. A lot of people constantly show up asking, where can I get older shows? Of course, the only way that this show actually exists and makes the cash to go to Classic Gaming Expo or to do whatever we need to do for the show comes through the purchase of our DVD-ROMs. And we have several different SKUs right now in terms of what you can buy with Retro Gaming Radio content. We have the Year 5, the Year 6, the Year 1 through 5 collection, and now the Retro Gaming Radio Starving Student Edition. Which, for those of you who are brand new to the show, just a quick overview. The Starving Student Edition is the shows only in MP3 format for the last 6 years. The first 6 years, I should say, of the show. It's all there. MP3s, no extras, no bonuses, comes on plain CDs, no jewel case, no inserts, nothing. I even label them with post-it notes. That's how cheap it is. But it's a ton of shows at a good price. For those of you who are real diehard fans of the show, you'll want to look at the DVD-ROM editions, which offer up lots of extras, lots of cut material, bloopers, behind-the-scenes jam sessions that we never aired, tons and tons of stuff. These are the real collector edition DVDs, and of course they're considerably more expensive. The Year 1 through 5 is pretty pricey, but again, you know, you're talking about 70 hours of content. Where are you going to get that for that price? So, good stuff. Like I said, once a month I like to bring it up, especially now that we have the new Starving Students edition, and tons of people have already picked that up to hear some of the older shows, and several of them have actually came back and bought the DVDs afterwards. So it's a good tool. It worked out better than I thought. So anyway, just a little touch on the base. If you're interested in those discs, go to RetroGamingRadio.com. This month we feature the beginnings of an interview with Keith Robinson from the Classic Gaming Expo 2005. Keith is one of the original Blue Sky Rangers, one of the original Intellivision guys. This is the guy that you always see in the pictures running around in the Burger Time outfit, the silver-haired Jerry Garcia-looking dude. Yeah, that's him. And he sat down with us, which is really funny. You know, just as a back note on here, I always thought that for some reason Keith didn't like us, because we've been going to CGE for like 4 years, and he's never been interested in giving us an interview. We've tried to get a hold of him, but he's a busy guy. I mean, he's off cooking stuff in the middle of the show. I mean, you see smoke coming from their booth, right? But anyway, Keith's a really good guy, and he sat down to tell us about what's going on with the Intellivision properties. Namely, the thing that got me really excited was they're making Intellivision Lives for the Nintendo DS. And they're actually, for the first time, you're going to be able to experience an Intellivision game almost controlled in a methodology that was used by the real controllers. Anyway, I don't want to spoil too much of the interview. I could sit and listen to this guy for a long, long time. We got so much interview time with him. It's great. And I hope you enjoy this. Keith Robinson from the Classic Gaming Expo 2005. This is Shane Armandrow at the Classic Gaming Expo 2005. I'm here with Keith Robinson from the Intellivision Productions Incorporated, talking about all the cool new Intellivision products that are coming out, along with some of the existing Intellivision, and just some overall history of the Intellivision. Keith, thanks for joining us on the show.
You bet. My pleasure.
Give us a little history about Intellivision.
Well, it was started by Mattel in back in about 1979. It was test marketed. In 1980 is when it was introduced nationally to compete with the Atari 2600. And the famous thing that really put us on the map were our sports games, because at the time, video games were new. people weren't exactly sure what a video game was or what it was supposed to look like. But by doing a sports game, they could show a comparison on TV and say, here's Atari baseball,
right,
and here's Intellivision baseball. And you look at Atari baseball, you didn't see a baseball diamond.
Right,
but you looked at an Intellivision, and there was a baseball diamond. And so even people who didn't know what a video game was, they knew what baseball was. And they said,
right,
gee, that baseball game's got a baseball diamond.
Right.
And so it was the sports games that really put us on the map.
Those, interesting.
Those George Plimpton comparison ones. And then Atari tried to fight back and say, well, but we've got the space game. So Intellivision put out a lot of space games, like Astro Smash and Space Battle, that were really good. And that's where really the competition started going. And you'd see it. That was the first competition. You know, back then it was like, well, the Atari 2600, the Odyssey came out and kind of went. The Fairchild kind of came and went. But with Atari 2600 and Intellivision, you had this head-to-head fight. And ever since then, you've had this head-to-head fight. It went from that to then Nintendo and Sega, and then, you know, then you had PlayStation and Xbox, so you've always had that head-to-head fight going on, and that all started with the Intellivision Atari 2600 back in 1980.
And you guys had some, now I can't remember which direction it was, either Atari was trying to hire your programmers, or you guys were trying to hire their programmers. There was some fiasco with the programmers, wasn't there, back then?
Well, the that's how we came up with the moniker Blue Sky Rangers, which has stuck to this day, is that Mattel wanted to keep secrets who we were, because it was a lot of hiring,
right,
back and forth.
Okay.
Atari was trying to raid our programmers. In general, we weren't raiding other places, but Activision, iMagic, Coleco, all of these companies were trying to hire experienced programmers.
Sure.
And so they were stealing our people, and so Mattel tried to make it very difficult for them to find, which didn't really work.
Right.
I mean, because they were offering like $500 for somebody to get out a phone book from Mattel with the internal numbers, and the headhunters were calling all the time.
Right,
but,
of course.
But in articles and everything, they always kept us secret. And so when TV Guide did an article about us, they wouldn't let them use just about anything that would in any way identify any of us.
Black
so the guy, silhouettes. Yes, the guy who was writing the article wanted some sort of a name that he could call us.
Right.
Because application software division didn't sound very sexy.
Right, no,
so
not
he
sexy
came,
at all.
He came up with the name Blue Sky Rangers, the guy who actually wrote the article.
Interesting.
He came up, and if you actually read the article, it says, these are the Blue Sky Rangers, because we didn't call ourselves that. So he couldn't say they call themselves the Blue Sky Rangers, they're named the Blue Sky Rangers, because we weren't. Since he created it, he wrote it, they are the Blue Sky Rangers, because he made it
so
up.
So is he like getting kickbacks now, or what's the deal with that?
It's funny, I actually located him a few years ago.
Really?
Because we wanted to reprint the article.
Sure.
And so we got permission from TV Guide, and we also got permission from him. Howard Polskin is his name. And I ran across him, and to this day we invite him to reunions and everything. He's never come to one, but he's always kind of sent letters, and he's kind of like happy to be remembered as the guy who coined the phrase Blue Sky Rangers.
And did he ever say where he came up with that? Did he just pick it out
well,
of the air?
It's because we had Blue Sky sessions. We did call our brainstorming sessions Blue Sky sessions.
Gotcha.
And so when he heard that we were having a Blue Sky meeting, he just from that he created Blue Sky Ranger.
Gotcha.
And now, so we created a logo.
Oh, right.
Mark Urbanek, one of the other programmers, and I, we sat down at a local rib shot, and on a napkin we drew up a little picture of the head of our department, the vice president, Gabriel, and we changed it. His name was changed to Hal in the article. So we made In Hal We Trust with a drawing of him and put the wings on it, made Blue Sky Rangers, and we made the logo, which we put it on T-shirts back then in 1982.
Sure.
And now it's on our website and the whole thing, and people, it became a good way to recognize with all the people who were doing Intellivision websites when we first started,
right,
a way of identifying ours. This is the official Blue Sky Ranger site. We're the real programmers. We're the guys. And so it was a way to identify us to this day, even though now we can say our names and here we are and here's the credits and everything. People still say, oh, the Blue Sky Rangers.
You know, it's interesting. One of the common things that everybody says about or talks about in terms of Intellivision, you got to set it to rest. What's with the little disc controller? I've got to know. I mean, I had cramped thumbs and everything really quick. You almost didn't think that something like that would get through QA because it just... What was the thought process behind that, guy?
They were designed within Mattel. An engineer named Dave Chandler, his department in design development, put it together. The thought process was they were trying to make everything about the Intellivision better than the Atari.
Right.
The Atari had an 8-directional joystick, and so they said we'll put a 16-directional thing on there, and the whole idea of the 16-directional disc and the way that thing is, if you look at it internally, there's no moving parts inside that hand controller. It's actually a sandwich together of printed circuit material that has holes cut in it. So when you press, you're actually pressing through layers of plastic.
Gotcha.
And so it's just a squishy membrane of stuff. And even the hand controller, the wheel works that way.
Right.
And so if you actually had a joystick, there would be too much play. So by doing the disc,
right,
you can just make those connections with this. You know, you've got a layer of plastic, another layer that has holes cuts into it, and then another layer.
Right.
And so you're pressing so that that one layer goes through the hole and connects this other layer with the printed circuit material on it.
Gotcha.
In other words, it was cheap.
Right.
Basically, that's what we're getting
at. Well, you know, if you think about it, though, they shouldn't have worn out as fast either, right? Because the Ataris use the micro switch design type thing.
Yeah,
you
would think that.
The membrane.
Now, eventually, of course, that is what goes wrong with the Intellivision, is that membrane, that printed circuit material wears off. And it used to be, when INTV Corporation took over, they actually printed more membranes. They went to Hong Kong and printed new membranes, and you could actually, they would send you how to open it up and put a new membrane in. But that's really where they die, is that membrane goes bad. And people are always surprised when they open it up and find this folded piece of plastic inside.
Right.
And go, this is the mechanics of the hand controller? The Intellivision, when they designed it, you have to remember, Mattel was a toy company.
Right.
And here suddenly they were designing something for the first time that was going to cost $300. And everyone at Mattel was very nervous about this. In fact,
I bet,
when the Atari 2600 came out, that's when they started designing the Intellivision. Well, if you remember, and a lot of people don't remember this, the Atari 2600 was not a huge seller when it came out.
Hmm.
Nolan Bushnell had ordered 800,000 of them. And Christmas came and went, and they sold 300,000.
Wow.
And that's why Time Warner, or I guess just Warner at the time,
yeah, right,
that's why Warner kicked him out, or he resigned over the limits they put on him, because here he had ordered 800,000, only sold 300,000, 500,000 warehouses. And so Mattel saw that. Mattel put the whole Intellivision project on hold. They said, that 2600 didn't fly.
Right.
Well, the 2600 started, what happened was the 2600, they then released Space Invaders.
Right.
And what people to this day cannot remember is it's not the console, it's the killer app.
Absolutely.
And the thing was, with the 2600, everybody wanted to play Space Invaders at home.
Right.
And when they got Space Invaders, suddenly those other 500,000 flew out the window. Really, Atari was going to shut down the whole home division.
Hmm.
They were going to shut it down once they sold out those, and they were going to just concentrate on arcade machines. But once they saw what happened when you actually had that killer app, and they saw the sales that happened after you had Space Invaders, they went, oh, this is great. And Mattel said, whoa, let's get back onto Intellivision. They finished
right.
the television. But still, it was, for a toy company, that was a big risk,
sure,
designing a $300 item. So they did whatever they could to cut corners and to keep the cost out. The programmers they hired, most of us didn't have any experience. They hired right out of school, and they usually couldn't afford people out of college. They hired mostly out of, like, training institutes, technical institutes, people
right.
who had taken, like, a six-month course in programming to get there. The advantage of that was, instead of having a bunch of techies in there, we had mostly a bunch of creative people who had picked up some programming skills along the way. And that made for us a very diverse group. You didn't have this entire group of, just bit twiddlers. You had musicians, artists, you had lawyers, teachers, people who had all walks of life,
yeah,
and who had, but were also interested in computers and what a computer could do. That was and a lot of people we hired, had never seen a video game,
right,
and had only the slightest inkling of how to do microprocessor programming. But our motto was, it's easier to train somebody to program than it is to train somebody to be creative. So when we were hiring, we were looking for creative people.
Sure, that makes good sense.
Who had some technical background. I mean, they had to be able to at least, recognize how to do a little assembly language programming. We couldn't train them from the very beginning. But if they'd had some training, we brought them in. And like I say, they were all walks of life. And as a result, what we really put together was a creative team as opposed to a technical team. And I think that's why we had so much fun there, why we did such good games, and why to this day the group has stayed together as a group. We always are having reunions, getting together, and a lot of the people have started their own companies Bill Fisher, one of the Blue Sky Rangers, owns Quicksilver Software, which did a lot of the Interplay games. It's done a lot of the Star Trek games for the PC.
Right, I thought the name sounded familiar.
Dave Warhol started Real Time Associates, which did a lot of Sega games. They did Bug for Sega Saturn, which was like the real launch of Sega Saturn, and did a lot of the Ren and Stimpy games, a lot of the cartoon games were done in real time. And Don Daglow started Stormfront Studios, which did the first multiplayer game on AOL was their game, and has done a lot of revolutionary games, and just recently did like the Two Towers games.
We had him on the show last year. It was a good interview.
So a lot of these people have started these companies and then have hired back people from Mattel. So I don't have actual empirical data to prove this, but I would say that of the group we put together for Intellivision, there's a higher percentage of them still working in games than probably any other video game company together from Atari or iMagic or Activision or anything. We probably get the highest percentage that are still doing just purely games because they were a creative group.
Now, growing up where I did not, and this is not representative at all of the general population, and Intellivision was not necessarily not taken seriously, but for some reason nobody I knew ever had an Intellivision, but everybody had a ColecoVision, everybody had an Atari. And again, this could be totally where I lived, you know. But is that representative? And if so, why didn't Intellivision just storm out in front? I mean, was it just the Atari's clout?
Well, first of all, Atari got the head start.
Right, of course.
They had a 2 or 3 year head start. Now, in Europe, there's a much higher percentage of Intellivision people than Atari people.
Oh, really?
And the reason is that, first of all, Mattel already had a good distribution there.
Helpful.
And second of all, Atari games all had to be reprogrammed for PAL.
Because
the Intellivision games, it has a separate video chip, and the program doesn't have to change. All you have to do is change the RF modulator.
Gotcha. Okay,
so
that's great.
On television, you change an RF modulator, and the same cartridge you sell in the United States can be sold in England, can be sold in France, can be sold. So CCAM, PAL, whatever, you just need to put in the different modulator. You have to reprogram the Atari games because the game and the scan lines
are
all
integral. 320 by 200 versus 250 or 6
or
whatever.
All integral in terms of how the game is designed.
Wow.
So that gave us a head start. Not a head start, but at least it put us on even footing pretty much in Europe for distribution. So in Europe, they really saw, oh, this is a good game. And the other thing was Atari, you know, when we introduced the Intellivision, it was $300. At the time, Atari was $150.
That's
now,
tough.
Eventually, the
you
price
got
down. And but, you know, because of that, you know, in the heyday back in 1982, 83, there were 12 million Ataris and there were 3 million Intellivisions. So we had about 20% of the market.
And very respectable coming in when you did.
You know, it's you know, and you can look at it kind of like the Macintosh versus PC. We had a much higher part of the market than Macintosh ever did.
Sure.
And we were kind of considered the, you know, to a lot of people, they have that loyalty to the Intellivision the way Macintosh people have loyalty to the Macintosh. Yeah, it's like, yes, there were four times as many Atari units out there, but the people at the Intellivision really felt that, you know, hey, look at these sports games. Look at, you know, some of these games. Now, the reality is each system has its strengths.
Sure.
And when you design a game for the system, you get a great game. And what happened was eventually, as all of the companies started saying, well, to maximize our profit, we have to make every game fit on every system.
Right.
Then you start compromising. And you can do a great game for the 2600, and you can do a great game for the Intellivision, but it's really hard to do a game that's great on both.
Sure.
And that's where, as marketing more and more wanted to be what they called all flavors, that's when you started seeing kind of a breakdown.
See, that's like totally different than today. Game makers today want, or well, game console companies want exclusivity. You don't want to see a screen that says Xbox version, PlayStation version, and everything. No. They want to say Xbox exclusive.
Right. Well, but remember, you have a different dynamic. And this is why we had the crash in 1983. If Activision made a game for the Intellivision, Mattel saw no money on that.
Hmm.
They didn't have to license from us. Today, if you release a game for the PlayStation or the Xbox, you have to license. You first have to get a license that costs hundreds of thousands of dollars just to do it.
Right.
And then you have to pay them to manufacture it. So Sony's going to make like $10 off of every item you sell for the PlayStation 2.
Right.
So they're going to make their money whether, you know, You put it on their system, they're making money.
Right.
That didn't happen in 1983. So you could have 100 companies get into the business, which they did, and they were making Atari games, and they were making television games, and Atari wasn't seeing any money from that, and Mattel wasn't seeing any money from that.
Interesting.
So if there were, 50 games on the shelf, and 5 of them was from Mattel, and the other 45 weren't, people would buy those games for the television. Mattel's not seeing any money. And so there's where your crash happened, is that you had all these people getting into it, but the manufacturers weren't getting enough of the pie to continue to make the hardware, because you don't make the money on the hardware.
Right.
The hardware is like the loss leader to get to sell the cartridges. Well, today, in today's market, that works. Sony can sell a PlayStation and make almost nothing on it. I mean, they could just give away the PlayStations and give away the Xbox, and they could make money.
Right.
Because they'd make their money on the licensing fees they get from people making games for them. In fact, that might be a better model. Call up Sony. I've got an idea for them. Give them away. Just give them away on the street.
Tons of games. It might happen that way in the next gen.
Well, that's almost what they're doing now.
Though. Oh, yeah.
They're really just breaking even on that stuff. And in fact, I think Microsoft was losing money for a while on the Xbox, which legally you're not supposed to do, but I think
how does that work out?
Yeah.
How much of what they do is legal anyway?
Yeah, well, but because you're making money off of the cartridge. We weren't in those days, so as we dropped the price to compete, at the end, in 1983, we were selling the Intellivision 2 for $70. So you're selling it for $70, we're making nothing off of that. But if the cartridges are all being made by Activision or iMagic, we're making nothing at all.
So that's where
the crash happened. That's where the 83 crash happened.
Sure.
That's where it came back, was when Nintendo came into the United States, they came in with this whole system where you have to license the name, you have to be an official Nintendo, we are going to check the quality, because there was no quality control either.
Right.
These guys are going to make a game for the Intellivision. If it's a horrible game, it's a bad reputation for us.
Right.
Now, that's what happened. A lot of bad games came out. The public doesn't know how to, which game to go. Well, now, you pay a game for the Nintendo. Nintendo is going to check the quality. They're going to make sure there's not a glut of, like 15 different baseball games.
Right.
They're going to say, no, we have enough baseball games. You can't do baseball now. You have to do football. And no, that game isn't good enough. There's bugs in it. So we're not going to have it. And Sony does that now. And Xbox and Microsoft does it. They have quality control. They have concept approval, and so they can keep more of an eye. They can make the consumer happier, and so they've been quite successful now. So you're not going to see that type of crash that happened in '83 with that feeding frenzy where everybody got killed.
Now, a lot of people speculate that the reason that Intellivision may not have been able to run, other than the way we've already talked about, was the licensed games, the Space Invaders, the Asteroids. You guys had great versions of the games, but people saw Space Armada, like, what the hell is that? I don't even know what that is. Now, Space Invaders, I know what that is. I'll buy an Atari. What was that? Was that all about cash there?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. Pretty much. And plus, the other thing that happened was that, like 20th Century Fox, they started their own game division. Their titles, like MASH and everything, they had their own titles. It was essentially that Atari managed Atari and then Coleco. When Coleco got into it, Coleco just opened up the pocketbooks and we'll take Donkey Kong, we'll take everything. And they licensed everything. And that was a way that if you got into the business, Parker Brothers gets into the business. Parker Brothers says, we're going to do video games. Well, the first thing they do is they get Empire Strikes Back.
Right.
They get James Bond. They get, Popeye and all. They just started licensing things left and right. And so that's the way a company got into it. Mattel tried to stay away from that sort of licensing. They knew they had to do it, but they wound up always being kind of late with the licenses and stuff. They never got great licenses. The one license they got that was worth anything from the arcade, they lucked into. They made a deal with Data East Corporation, and they had the Data East games. Well, the Data East games had no distribution. Nobody knew what they were. But luckily, the game Burger Time was so good that Midway picked it up. So Midway put it in every arcade, and so Burger Time was actually a hit totally by luck because a different arcade company licensed it. So
interesting.
That was our only real good arcade license.
Well, that was a great game. I mean,
was Burger
beautiful
Time.
On the...
Well, it also was a wonderful... Ray Kessner, who's here.
It's a great game.
he did a great translation of it. And the reason for that is he was getting married. And he was getting married in 3 months, and they told him to do this conversion. He didn't want to be working on this game and programming it while he was getting ready for his wedding. So
right.
he like pretty much stayed up every night and went through it, and in 1 month did the whole game.
Wow.
And then in the next 2 months of time he had, he watched other people play it, and he fine-tuned it. How do you make it so, oh, just it's coming around, and oh, you're just about to, oh, and then you can slip by, and you can get around the corners and all of this. And he watched other people play, and he watched them play, and watched them play, and he just made fine tunes and tweaks. And even on his wedding day, the ushers before the wedding were playing Burger Time in the reception hall and everything. And he was watching them play. And so he was able to make that game fun. And that's the problem you don't have today. You don't have that luxury of that time of taking 2 months just to let people play it and make it have fun, because games that are so complicated that you're trying to get all the graphics in, you're trying to get all the music in, you're trying to get all the stuff in. But in those days, we had very simple music, very simple graphics. So it was all about the gameplay and how do you make it fun. And when you could do that, when you could take a month or 2 months to do nothing but play it, Dave Warhol did this with Mindstrike. He did the game, and then he and Mark Buchanani, another programmer, just spent like a month playing the game. Every day they just played the game, and he would then tweak it. Oh, this would make the game a little bit more fun. This would make it a little fun. They don't have that. The only people who do that today, really, is some of the Nintendo games. The Mario games get that kind of attention, kind of tweaking, that kind of play testing. And a lot of games, especially licensed games, this was a problem then, it's the problem now. Your licensed game has to get out there while the property is still hot.
Right.
So you've got a deadline. So even if the game isn't fully finished, even if the game isn't fully fun, get that game out there. You know, it's like, of course, the famous example back in the 80s was the E.T. game. And I always hate talking about this, because every time I've talked about this, the people the interviewers have then cut to the guy who wrote the game.
Right.
So it's always me bad-mouthing it. And what really destroyed it was the E.T. game, and then they cut to the guy who wrote it going, well, they only gave me like 6 weeks to write it, and I challenge anybody else to write a game in 6 weeks. At least it was a game, it was finished. And I feel sorry for this guy, because it's like I'm always like hitting him with a chair every time I interview him. But you know, that was a case where they had a multi-million-dollar license and said it's got to be finished in 6 weeks. How can you make a game and play it and make it fun and test it and everything and know it's going to be fun in 6 weeks? You can't do it.
Well, see,
and now, of course, when a game costs $1 million or $3 million to produce and has a staff of 20 people working on
right.
it, all trying to coordinate, and it's the Lord of the Rings game, so it has to be done at this time to get it out in the marketplace, the pressure of the deadline, you're not going to have that luxury of fine-tuning it and just really making it fun.
Yeah, and Howard Scott Warshaw's defense, though, he had E.T., which we'll just kind of forget about, but he had Yar's Revenge and he had Indiana Jones. Both, to me, totally erased E.T. from my memory.
Oh,
those are such great games.
Well, Ray Kessner always jokes. People talk about Burger Time just being fantastic.
Fantastic.
He later, for INTV Corporation, he did Super Pro Hockey, Slapshot
right.
Super Pro Hockey. And there was a magazine reviewer who earlier had talked about Burger Time being the greatest game ever, called Slapshot Super Pro Hockey just the worst game ever for the Intellivision. So Ray Kessner is joking that he did both the best game ever for the Intellivision
right.
and the worst game ever for
that's
the Intellivision.
That's when you become a legend, when you can hit both ends of the spectrum.
You know, so
what happened,
he puts it in perspective that way.
This is something that I, for some reason, always sticks in my head, and I'm sure there's a very simple explanation. AD&D.
Yes.
What was that whole thing about? What happened with that? There was Advanced Dungeons and Dragons on the Intellivision, but then
yes.
something happened, the license got dropped or something, then it became something else.
Yeah, it's very simple. What happened is that Tom Lowry designed the Dungeons and Dragons game. I mean, it was not Dungeons and Dragons, it was a game called Adventure. He called it Adventure.
Right.
And it was in the catalogs, coming soon, Adventure. And he finished it. And the game was finished, and he started working on his next game, which he called Minotaur. And he was working on Minotaur. And then they were just about to release Adventure, and then Atari came in and trademarked the game
yeah.
Adventure.
Right. Okay.
And so they said, oh, well, we've lost the name Adventure. What are we going to call it? And, you know, said, so we have this great Dungeons & Dragons type game. What are we going to call it? And they said, why don't we license the name Dungeons & Dragons? So they went to TSR, which was the owner of it, and they licensed the name. So it was called Adventure. They brought in the name. Minotaur was in the process of, you know, Tom Lowry was kind of finishing up Minotaur. Well, hey, And they released Advanced Dungeons and Dragons. Huge hit.
Right.
It was the biggest selling game we did in 1982.
Right. It's a great game.
Great game. Fantastic. Tom Lowry just did a fantastic job on it. And Treasures of Tarman was shaped, or Minotaur was shaping up to be a great game. It was also a Dungeons and Dragons style game. Great. Let's license the name for that. Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, Treasures of Tarman. And just terrific. And then another game was in development that Bill Goodrich was doing, which was called, he called it Quest, and it was a voice game. But again, a Dungeons & Dragons type game. So they said, hey, we'll make that a Dungeons & Dragons game. And then there was another game that they were starting to look at as an idea for a game that, and they said, hey, we'll make that one again. So we had this light, you know, and it was going to be called Tower of Mystery. Advanced Dungeons & Dragons Tower of Mystery. And the other one never really came up with a name. It was Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, and we don't know what it would have been called. It never got that far, but those were kind of in the workings. And then when Mattel went and sold Intellivision to INTV Corporation, well, they didn't want to pay the license. They didn't want to pay TSR the license. So they just they didn't release Quest at all, and the Tower of Mystery game became Tower of Doom, and they dropped the Dungeons & Dragons name off of it. And when we re-released, when we came out with our collection, Intellivision Lives, our lawyer looked at it and said, well, from his standpoint, his reading of it was, since we had developed the game at Mattel with no input on characters, gameplay, or anything else from TSR,
right,
we could still release the game as long as we didn't call it Dungeons & Dragons.
Right.
So we put it on our collection as Adventure, and the other one as Minotaur, because that's how they were developed at Mattel.
Right.
It's under those names. Now, when we've licensed to other companies, to Crave for the console games, to Activision that did the first PlayStation one, we've explained that story to them. And their legal departments have always gone, well, we don't want anyone from them showing up, because that's now Atari.
Right.
Dungeons & Dragons is now owned by Atari. So
yeah,
they say, we don't want Atari knocking on our door and saying, hey, isn't that our Dungeons & Dragons game from back then?
That sucks.
And so they say, well, we'll put those games on if you indemnify us against Atari suing you. And we're saying, well, we don't know. You know.
Yeah.
No. That's basically what we said.
Yeah.
So for the ones that we publish ourselves in-house, we're willing to say we own those games. Those games were designed actually at APH, which was the company that was contracted by Mattel. It was designed by APH under contract to Mattel. That game was finished and done by Tom Lowry before there was ever a Dungeons & Dragons name on it. We'll take that name off of it, but we have the rights to the game itself, and we're going to sell it. And if any other company wants to license it from us and do that with a different name, great. But so far, they haven't stepped up to do that, which is a shame because they're great games.
It's a very great game.
And the fact of the matter is, though, we have done some talks with Atari, and we may wind up licensing it, licensing back the name, simply so it can be on some of these other platforms.
Yeah,
the one nice thing has been, you know, we started this company in 1997, and we looked at licensing some of the stuff for our first release, which was 98, and we were a little company doing this ourselves.
Sure.
I mean, I was operating out of my house at that point when we were doing this. We couldn't afford, I mean, there's an unreleased Rocky and Bullwinkle game. And at the time, because Universal was releasing the Rocky and Bullwinkle, they had the rights to video games. And we said, hey, can we release this unreleased game? And they said, for $10,000, you can. And we went,
you'll be right there.
No, I don't think we're going to do that.
The check.
But as we've gone along and as we've had great success with especially the Technosaurus plug and play, has been a phenomenal seller for us, and the licensing fees, as that's happened, it's allowed us to do things that in 1998 we couldn't have considered doing.
Right.
We are releasing new cartridges, actual new cartridges. That's not going to make us any money.
Right.
You know, we're probably going to sell 500 of each of these cartridges to the true collectors. But it allows us to do things like that, to really kind of bring some stuff out that's never been seen before, because these other things are selling. And so we're hopeful that now there'll be some things which, because of licensing, because of legal entanglements, have been kind of blocked from us. We're hoping that we can, you know, more and more undo those knocks and get these things out there. Every time we release something, there's something new. There's something else you haven't seen before, because we've been able to go that extra step because of you know, frankly, having a little bit more money now. So.
Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, there's a huge controversy amongst my listeners about the whole plug-and-play TV games thing. We talked a little bit about it offline.
Right.
Just to set the record straight, the Intellivision controllers are using the Nintendo 8-bit
All of the plug-and-play things are the same thing. Somebody in Hong Kong created a way to put a Nintendo chipset onto one chip that's battery-operated and, I don't know, sells for like a couple bucks.
Right.
And that's what launched that. And that's what everybody uses because that's practical. Now, I would love to see a true Intellivision chipset there, but that's going to cost millions of dollars to start up
right.
when this other thing already exists. So, yes, it's not the 100. Everything has to be reprogrammed. What you're
right.
seeing is, I kind of look at it like, hey, if we had stayed in business long enough, we would have ported our games to Nintendo. You're seeing the ports of the Intellivision
right,
game
the
on the Nintendo
version.
System.
Yeah,
that's,
right.
what you're, that's what you're actually getting. You're getting the NES versions on this. But the thing that we did because of that, that's why deliberately, you know, the Atari ones, they make them look like a joystick. And then
right.
and the Namco's, we deliberately did not try to make it look like an Intellivision hand controller or something like
right.
that. Well, for one thing, because of those number of buttons, they couldn't have been afforded to do it. They
yeah.
had to work with something that was sort of limited button press because of that Nintendo type of buildup. Because Nintendo can't, I mean, just a little side thing, the reason why there are so many input, you could put so many inputs onto an Intellivision is it's actually the sound chip. The sound chip has an input port.
Huh.
And all of the Intellivision controls are going through the sound chip.
Really? Interesting.
yeah.
That's interesting. I did not know that.
If you open up an Intellivision, you'll find that the hand controllers are wired to the sound chip. It looks very odd, but that's how it works.
Well, with the success of like the Flashback, which I guess the Flashback 2 is actually real
hardware.
The Flashback
2 is, yes.
Is the real deal.
It's actually the real deal.
With the success of that and the
yes.
pre-sales and the mad money that's coming in, is Intellivision going to do that?
I'm hoping that my... either that or... my prediction is, and this is just a prediction, but just knowing the way technology is going, I will bet you that within 5 years, someone will do what they did with the NES, someone will do that with a Pentium chip. Now, putting a 1610 on a chip, other than Intellivision, there's not much use for that, but somebody could put a Pentium with ROM
right.
on a chip, battery operated, and make it for $5 a chip. There are plenty of applications that could use that.
Well, like every emulator, like the date for every system that dates before 1990, you could get on that.
And not even games. There's
yeah.
other
oh,
there's
sure.
other purposes for it.
Well, absolutely.
So somebody's going to do it. And if somebody does that, then yes, then we could do our fully emulated versions that are really good. And then it just comes down to the point is, could we manufacture a hand controller that is, you know, comparable to the original hand controller? The last time we had some pricing done on it, we had a company that said for $30,000 they could make 5,000 of them. Still pricey. But this technology has been dropping in price, and I'm hoping, and my prediction would be within 5 years you see it. And within 5 years you would see an Intellivision hand controller with a library of games that are
right.
playing fully 100% emulated perfect games. But, like I say, we went with the look of not looking like the Intellivision and looking like today's game controllers
right.
to kind of say, this isn't for the collector. This isn't for the Intellivision purist. This is for the new generation. This
right.
is to introduce kids to it. This is to introduce young kids who aren't playing with the, you know, aren't playing with the Xbox or the, you know, but they are being introduced to it. We have gotten our best reviews we get are like Parents Magazine, even Grandparents Magazine recommended us because you can put kids in the back seat of the car, plug us in the SUV to the and the kids will stay quiet for 2 hours because the kids, a 5-year-old, 10-year-old kid,
right.
they look at these games and they love them.
Yeah, they
don't
know any different.
They're simple arcade games that they can sit them and play.
I love
and they
them.
Can
I'm like 36.
Right. And so yes, I mean it's you know it's frustrating. You go into Amazon.com. And all of the reviews for it are bad. And you can tell it's because all the reviews are from Intellivision purists who say, well, it doesn't have the sound on Astrobot, and the music isn't there at the end of Shark
right.
Shark. And it doesn't have the number of colors. And that's because, whereas it's easier to duplicate the Atari 2600 and
yeah.
even some of those Namco games onto the chip, in some ways the Intellivision was more sophisticated than the Nintendo.
Sure.
So there's some things you can't duplicate on the Nintendo that we could do on the Intellivision.
Sure.
And so, yes, so there's some things that are missing. So the purists, but we warn them on our website. We, you know, we have the quotes there. The purists are going to object, but it's
sure.
not for them. It's to introduce it to a new generation. And, like I say, we've sold... You know, Intellivision Lives, which is our best thing. It's the
right.
best thing we've done.
Yeah, we're going to get to that.
We've sold about 10,000 of those.
Really? That's all?
Yeah,
that's,
but we've sold
like
2 million. 2 million of the plug-and-play units.
But aren't the plug-and-play units, though, aren't those, I mean, those are like everywhere. Those are in Walmart,
yes.
Target. I mean, I could dump over a trash can somewhere and probably find one that someone, because they're everywhere.
Yes.
But
yes.
You don't see the Intellivision Lives necessarily everywhere you see one of those.
No. Well, the Intellivision Lives is, you know, our own thing, and we don't distribute to stores. It's on our website. That's our Cadillac product.
Right.
The other ones, the console ones that Crave puts out, they have good distribution. And
yeah.
You can generally where you find, you know, PlayStation 2, Xbox, GameCube, you'll generally find, you know, our stuff there.
Well, let's talk about Intellivision Lives.
You know, combined, we've probably sold, and I don't know what the exact numbers are, I haven't looked lately, but on the console games, we've probably sold over 250,000.
Wow,
the various
that's a pretty good number
there.
It's a niche deal.
Yeah, so I would say probably if you combine the PlayStation 2, Xbox, and GameCube, we're probably around 250,000 sales all together there. But it still doesn't touch the plug-and-play stuff.
No, it's insane.
Because a new generation is coming in. And
they made those very hip Jack's hats.
Yes.
They really made that like a household deal. I mean,
right.
Damn it, I hate to admit it, I own a couple of them.
Oh,
just
because so
I was curious, if nothing else.
So do I. I've got the Namco one. I've got the Pac-Man one. they're good. They're fun. They're fun games. And yes, they are not still. I mean, there are people who complain about those, the purists, because you know, you're playing Pac-Man. You're not playing the exact same patterns. You're not.
Yeah.
You know, you're playing something that's good, and it's fun. But if you're looking for, oh, it's got to be the exact original arcade, that's not where to go. For that, you need to go and get a PC version or a PlayStation 2 fully emulated version, which is great. And we try to offer both.
We'd like to thank Keith Robinson for sitting down with us at the Classic Gaming Expo 2005. Tune in next month for the final part two of our interview with Keith. Good stuff. I think you'll enjoy it. Always fun talking to guys who are in the bowels of the industry in the beginning. So come back next month and check that out. As usual, we have a giant Bits and Bytes segment contributed largely by you, the listener. And we got some really good stuff. I'm really pleased this month. We got some kind of different stuff, which is always cool. Let's start off with classic arcade sounds. Now, from what I understand about this, some kid back in like 1982 went out and brought a tape recorder. I mean, not like an MP3 player that records audio, but, you know, cassette tapes. Took a cassette tape recorder out with him while he played video games and recorded sounds of hundreds of different classic arcade games. Some things, of course, are really commonplace, like, you know, Zaxxon or Dig Dug, but he's got some interesting ones in here, things like Stratavox and Turbo, The Pit, Eyes, things a lot of people may not have heard. So it's kind of cool that somebody managed to share this. So this is pretty cool. Anyway, they got a picture of the tape recorder and everything. So anyway, I thought that was kind of a neat thing that I hadn't really seen before. Somebody that had actually gone through the effort of recording these things. So anyway, the files are really small. They only have short clips of each video game. So I checked that out. I had a good time. I mean, I sat through. There's pages and pages of this stuff. Dragon's Lair, of course, Punch-Outs, Up and Down. I'm poking through. He's got like 14 or 15 lists here. Night Stalker, Iron Horse. I mean, there's just tons of stuff in here. So I would definitely recommend taking a look at that, because that's pretty cool that somebody really managed to... We talk about preserving nostalgia for future generations. This isn't just somebody firing up MAME and doing a stereo mix out recording of it and, you know, building this. I mean, this is a piece of history. This is like before, you know, VCRs were real commonplace. You know, this is before people even thought to record stuff they might care about later. So this is good stuff. Anyway, I spent quite a bit of time on. I think you guys will really appreciate it. Normally, I don't get all excited about the web-top distractions that get sent in. This month, we had a pretty funny one sent in called Don't Push the Red Button. Or Press the Red Button, sorry. And in this one, it starts off with a seemingly random spew of why you shouldn't press the button every time that you do. And then eventually, it comes up with something a little more ingenious. Anyway, I think you guys will get a kick out of it. It'll burn like 5 minutes of your time, but you know, that's what web-top distractions are for. So I had to share that one this month. A site called HomeStarRunner.com provides us with some interesting flash distractions this month. The entire thing is old, like, flash games. Some of them are like representations of like old Game & Watch games. These aren't real translations. They're, how do you put it, in the style of these old games. Even the menu system is like a hybrid NES game 1942 type selector. Anyway, you shoot down one of these planes. It has a different type of game attached to it, and then you go and play that game. There's some interesting titles in here. I like the presentation, if nothing else. I like how when you mouse over the planes, you get an idea of, you know, what the game's going to be. It's kind of, if nothing else, it's an interesting menu, navigational menu. I like it when people take the classic look and feel and manage to wrap it into their own deal. In any event, there's a couple of good games to distract you this month. Very retro in feel, very simplex. Some weird stuff, too. I'm wondering if this is like European stuff, because it's like, you know, one of the games has you feeding a rhino. You just go and you grab food, you put it over in the rhino's dish, and you're avoiding these snakes that are going up and down the screen. I don't know. Crazy stuff, but again, fun nonetheless, and that's what gaming's all about, right? Remember Space War, like one of the first original video games? Came out of an MIT supercomputer, or I guess we wouldn't call it a supercomputer, but a large MIT computing solution. Anyway, this came out like back in 1962 or something crazy like that. But anyway, Space War is considered by many as the first computer game. And this link that we have here for you this month gives you a little bit of background, gives you some information about it, and also lets you play a Java version of the actual original game. The source code was 40 pages, just to give you some information that comes from this this page here. Ran on a DEC PDP-1 computer. Three MIT students were responsible for it. Anyway, there's a bunch more information on here, and of course the link to the applet where you can play the original Space War. And you can definitely tell how many games, and they are plentiful, that borrowed concepts and sometimes outright took the entire game for its inspiration. So there you go. Another little blast of the past there with Space War. Now, I swear we talked about this next item last month. This was the last Starfighter video game, and I'm sure someone will correct me on the forums, but just in case I missed out on it, these sort of efforts should not go unrewarded. If you remember the movie The Last Starfighter, there were tons and tons of controversial things about it. We've talked about it on the show in the past, namely the fact that the video game that the kid played in the movie, of course, didn't exist, and it was all animated, and, you know, it wasn't a video game, let's put it that way. And there were promises that the video game was actually going to ship with the movie coming out. It was one of those movie tie-in deals. But we never saw the video game, and a lot of people, there was tons of rumor mill going around. In fact, if you search for The Last Starfighter game fact on like Google or whatever, you'll find a huge, rich history of all sorts of stuff dealing with The Last Starfighter. Well, this month, we get a link sent to us by somebody who actually created the game. I mean, they took everything from the movie and created the actual game. Is that incredible or what? The original cabinet was destroyed after the movie was done, but apparently they managed to get the cabinet stuff, the side art, everything for this. And it seems to me, if I remember reading about it, and I'm trying to find where I saw that at, it was actually, oh yes, here we go. They actually got permission to make this. So this is an officially made Last Starfighter game. And it's pretty cool looking. I mean, if you look at the stills, it looks exactly like the movie, and that's great. I haven't had a chance to play it much. I played it like 5 minutes. I never really understood what the hell they were doing anyway. But that's pretty cool. That's from RogueSynapse.com. So, I mean, that's kind of cool. The final, I don't know, the final piece, if you will, of a historical journey is finally complete. We actually got the video game that was in Last Starfighter. So it's kind of interesting, you know, we talked about the last couple of months we've had, you know, David Comstock talking about his trials and tribulations about porting, you know, Cloak and Dagger over to the 5200. You know, it's funny that we're made these long promises in movies, things like War Games, you know, where we see, you know, full text-to-speech synthesis with absolutely no mispronunciations, and, of course, the realism of these are very different than what actually happens. But it's kind of fun, and it's interesting when somebody takes the time and effort to do something like this. So just in case I didn't talk about it last month, I wanted to make sure it got some press time, because that's pretty damn cool. Here we have another article talking about the rebirth of arcades in your home. This is, of course, talking about how prolific the next generation gaming consoles are going to be about bringing classics into your home. And I do want to point out that, you know, we talk about this in the editorial commentary this month, so I don't want to start ragging on it. But when you start talking about bringing the classics, there's a considerable difference between MAME and some reimagined high-resolution version of Robotron. You know, there are parameters you have to work within in order to achieve nostalgia. And I don't believe putting, you know, Robotron in, you know, 1080p resolution is really, you know, complementary to that. It's nothing, it's no different to me than, you know, reimagining like the Retro Atari pack on the DS. You know, we reimagine the graphics in the game. It's like, dude, stop reimagining it. We wanted the original one. That's what we've always been wanting. But anyway, it's a pretty decent little article. It talks a little bit about what's forthcoming from the different platforms and sort of the historical value of it. So it was an interesting article. I figured I'd share it with you. Now, this is always fun. Sometimes old video games resurface that never got released, or there were always rumor mills about it or whatever, but this one, I think I can understand why it never got released. Desert Bus is a game where you drive from Tucson, Arizona to Las Vegas, and it does it in real time. So the game takes 8 hours to play. This is classic. And according to the link here, there is no scenery or even other cars on the road, just plain desert for 8 hours. Your bus veers to the right slightly, so it's impossible just to tape down a button and go do something else. Rumor has it that if you make it to Vegas, you score one whole point. That's pretty funny. That's pretty funny. Anyway, this was a Sega CD game, I guess. So, or maybe just a Sega Genesis game. It's a little interesting, the wording here, but it says it requires a Sega CD emulator. You can download this thing. It's on a Sega CD collection, so hard to say if it was originally developed for the Sega CD or not, but in any event, it reminds me of the Family Guy where Peter's at the arcade playing the virtual stuck behind a bus. I don't know why, maybe it's just the whole bus thing, but that's pretty funny. Just spend 8 hours driving. That's what I want to do with my free time. But you know, hey, the people that want to spend their life actually working in video games, you know, like Larry Kaplan that just wants to go and sell bones all day, hey, this is a perfect game. Drive a bus 8 hours. Commute. I'm telling you, that's where games are going. Too much like work for me. Apparently, this Desert Bus is part of a Penn and Teller, the comedian/magician duo, known for their HBO show that they have. Anyway, apparently this Sega CD game that came out was supposed to be their work, or, you know, whatever, their endorsed work. And apparently all of the games contained on there have something to do with Penn and Teller. Now, I don't know anything about Penn and Teller. I can't tell you if there's anything about driving a bus in there, but I did get several other people that mentioned this Penn and Teller's Smoke and Mirrors. And you can download the whole thing through BitTorrent, 810 megabytes. Anyway, there's a couple of other links we're going to give you that talk more about the background to it. Apparently, it was also in development for the 3DO. So, hey, I think that's pretty funny, though, the Desert Bus. 8 hours of driving. Man, you know, my back starts hurting when I even think about driving for 8 hours. Whatever. Here's another website doing something just slightly different than the norm. We've had lots of lists. In the old days, we used to call websites that had lots of items on it, lists, and you could subscribe to these lists, and they would send you updates to these lists every couple of weeks or whenever they made some sort of major addition to it. Well, now, of course, there's no such thing really as lists anymore. Now you just go to a website filled with a bunch of links on it. But these guys are doing something a little bit different. This is called the Arcade at the Movies website. And they have dedicated themselves to going out and taking stills of famous and infamous movies of various decades, showing kids or people playing video games inside of the movie. But it starts off with Soylent Green, and what is she playing here? Computer Space. There's a Pong being played. Anyway, this is very interesting. I kind of like this. At one point in time, I thought about doing something similar myself, taking snapshots or, you know, digitizing clips from movies showing people playing famous video games. So this is pretty cool. This also goes so far as to show non-video games or video games that were made up. Like in Future World, there was a chess game, a fantasy holodeck chess type game. And in Star Wars, for example, they have a Star Wars shot in here where they're playing the Archon-looking chess game. Of course, that was never a real game, but they've got it in here. So this is kind of cool. I mean, it's different from reading a list where it's just like blah, 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 blah. These actually have, like, screenshots, you know, clips. Being able to see somebody playing Death Race. Hell, you can barely find a cabinet, let alone see one in operation somewhere. So this is actually pretty cool. I'm trying to see. Of course, there's stuff from Tron and all of the, Fast Times at Ridgemont High. All the requirements are here. Hey, there's even a shot of Robotron. So, anyway, I thought that was pretty cool. More games, of course. Matthew Broderick playing Galaga. Blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I could sit here and talk for hours about cool video gaming and movies, but just go to the site. Make it easy. Oh, what do we got next? Man, so much stuff to do. Hey, listen, do me a favor while we're talking about it, while I've got a moment here in between. Be sure you check before you do any submissions that the site that you're sending me like doesn't have any like anti-linking technology, because what I'm seeing a lot of is people are sending me links to pictures and the pictures have some anti-linking things. So when I bring it up, all I see is "don't steal from my site, man," or linking of images is illegal. So do me a favor and like close your browser and check the link before you send it. That might be useful just to make sure that I actually get to see it, because I've had to delete several entries, which might have been interesting if somebody had actually, you know, double-checked and maybe downloaded and put it on somewhere that I could get to without it expiring. We have tons of problems with that. Content expiring. A lot of the Yahoo News, we talked about this before, but the Yahoo News and lots of stuff just expires like 20 days. Boom, dead. So it doesn't help our link archive when this stuff comes up. Anyway, what do we got here next? This is kind of a fun thing. It really has nothing to do with gaming, retro, or otherwise, but everyone knows that I like to talk smack about Microsoft and whatever. This is pretty funny. Somebody actually built a shell to allow you to make Windows 3.1 or 3.11, whatever, look and act like Windows XP. Calmera, I'm assuming is how it's pronounced, and the basic purpose of this thing is it gives you, it does have a couple of interesting things, other than just being like a shell, which is usually something I wouldn't talk about. It's like, who cares? Skins are for people who have no caring about, you know, functionality. They care about what it looks like. Give me a break. But in this case, they do actually like enable long file names. That's pretty cool, right? Because I remember what it was like to work in the old 8.3 days. In any event, so there are some enhancements made. Of course, it looks a little bit more aesthetically pleasing. But, hey, give people free time, and they'll lose their minds. Seriously, it's just insane. Okay, what else do we have? Oh, you know, there's a great new outrash of people submitting news, and I don't know how I'm going to get around this other than just delete the things. I keep getting, like, hotels and vacation spots from like exotic countries. Like, you know, I get like Korean and What was one I? What else did I get lately? There was another one that was just like totally bizarre. It's like, what the hell? You post this stuff. But anyway, so we try to make sure those don't sneak in. But I had to share. I mean, I get some of the weirdest stuff gets sent over. Lots of empty links, too, which shouldn't be possible unless people have JavaScript turned off because you can't even submit the form. Whatever. People will find a way to circumvent whatever you do. Just got to put it in there for the little guy. Remember Ocean Software? You either loved them or you hated them. Ocean tended to be the group of people that took every single movie or license that they could lay their paws on and somehow crank out a video game. Other people thought Ocean was like the total business. Well, this is a website dedicated to the Ocean experience. This is somebody's first-person perspective of what it was like to work for Ocean Software. There's some pretty good stuff in here. And, you know, the scenery on the page ain't bad either. So, check it out. If you're big into Ocean or not big into Ocean, they, of course, were big 8-bit computer guys, as well as Amiga, of course, and other machines. Commodore 64, and apparently the ZX Spectrum was their coding of choice. Anyway, much like the Team 17 stuff that we did in previous months, if you're interested in the old stuff, cool. If you're not, well, you might just want to bypass it. GameSpot.com did a tribute flashback to the NES. Here's an article here. It actually has a video, which is pretty funny. There's this girl with a Nintendo Power Glove on. 20 years ago, when the video game industry was still reeling from what has been commonly referred to as the video game crash of 1983, a small console called Nintendo Entertainment System made a big splash. It goes through and talks about what they call the 20-year-old legend. It's got some interesting type interview stuff with Nintendo themselves. Anyway, definitely worth looking into if you're a fan of old Nintendo stuff. That, of course, was the era that I was not pleased with Nintendo. So, what else do we have here? Yeah, see, some of this stuff, I swear, that we've been doing this for so long that I tend to forget what we've covered. It's insane. Okay, in the off chance that I haven't already talked about this, a couple of guys tried to run through, did a race to see who could finish Super Mario Brothers on the NES first. Apparently it was used on actual machines, and they shot a video, and we're going to give you a link to the video. So, with the new Super Mario Brothers coming out for the DS soon, seems like classic Mario Brothers fever is coming back out. But that's cool. I mean, Super Mario Brothers enslaved my sorry ass too, so, you know, I understand. Yeah, someone sent up another link too about glitches that exist inside of Super Mario Brothers, and I'm pretty sure we talked about that too, so I'm not going to mention it, but I'm going to go ahead and provide the link just in case. What else do we have here? Super Nintendo gaming, as good as it's going to get. And I know I posted this article as well, but this guy's basically talking to the effect of, you know, there was no need for another game machine after the Super Nintendo. That's how good it was. So you can read his rantings about that. Always good stuff. Let's see. What else do we got here? Here's one I know that we've posted in the past too before, but it's actually worthwhile. It is a flash animation telling you about how to post messages on a message forum. Classic stuff. Every now and then I don't mind revisiting some of this old stuff. I mean, I think we talked about this one like years ago. But sometimes the classic stuff's still fun to go revisit. So I know we have tons of new listeners. And every now and then it'll be cool to show off some of this older stuff. So check that link out. That's pretty funny. I mean, how to properly posting in you. It sounds like one of those old 50s, you know, to how to do science videos. You know, zinc oxide. Okay, next up, if there wasn't anything to make me want to scream more, then it is the overt popularity of the iPod. And we talked about this at great length, so I'm not going to drone on about it. But apparently somebody is working hard to port MAME to the iPod. Some games are already running, like the Pac-Man series. I can't imagine, honestly, the possibilities of playing This to me is like digital camera MAME. It's a proof of concept with very little collective good, you know. I mean, my okay, so what? My digital camera has a four-directional controller and a bunch of buttons on it. That doesn't mean I want to play freaking MAME on it. That's insane. This is more of the convergence demon coming out. And you know that stuff will never be legal. You know they're never going to come up with a method of doing this legally unless you buy some goofy-ass iTunes distributed half-ass knockoff of Ms. Pac-Man that has nothing to do really with the original code base. Anyway, I'll give you a link. You can check it out because I know there's a few of my listeners that have iPods and they aren't afraid to say it. But, you know, there's about a billion other devices better than iPod to play MAME on. Whatever. Okay, here is something kind of different. You know, we talk a lot about old devices that get new games, like every now and then. Like once a year, we get a new game for the 5200. We get a new game for the 2600. We see new games for the NES come out from time to time. But you know what you never see new games out for? The Commodore Plus 4 computer. Hell, half the people listening, you probably don't even know what the Commodore Plus 4 computer is. Hell, I've only seen one. I've never seen one in the wild. I've seen one like on a store display one time. But these guys actually made a shooter. Xenon Trioxide is what they call it. Xenon was actually a shooter game for the 16-bit computers. They may have made an 8-bit version. But in any event, these guys have gone the extra mile to build a glorious shoot 'em up game on the Commodore Plus 4. There's screenshots, all sorts of good stuff on here. So if you're a closet Plus 4 fan, you may want to check this out. There's a dangerous, creepy trend coming in video games right now. And I'm the only one that must not like it. I swear everybody else has major wood for this stuff. This is taking classic game styles like vector graphics games or what are essentially flash games, basic simple shooters with really, really, you know, low level primitives, circles, boxes, you know, as primitive as you can make it, and then taking and putting all these special effects on it. This month we got a game submitted called Mono, which, by the way, attempted to invoke the name of Robotron, which, as most of you know, in the past, you do not ever tell me that a game resembles Robotron unless it's really got its crap together. Mono, while it may be an interesting desktop distraction type game, in reality is a 6-meg demo, is one of these loud techno music while playing primitive looking games with tons of visual effects thrown all over. This is that Geometry Wars type. I first saw this with Tempest 2000, where they took Tempest and they just overload you with audio and visual and smears and blurs. I swear I'm the only person on the planet that doesn't like this stuff, but it bugs the crap out of me. So if you like this stuff, you want to go get Mono. Well, you want to get the game Mono. You don't want to actually get Mono. I don't know. This stuff bugs me, especially with the fact, at least they invoke the fact that they use PaintShop Pro, and it shows, to make the game. The music's pretty good, but it's like you're playing basically Asteroids with directional shooting, and it's got all the weird, you know, Geometry Wars type effects, the particles and the smears and the, I don't know, drives me crazy. I'm not entertained, but, you know, that's me. Okay, here's something interesting. You guys know that I write for Retro Gamer Magazine on the side as well. I do the America Free Retro article. We have here, this is something that just can't be done. And, you know, when Brian was still around, when he was alive, and many other times in the past, we've been asked, well, you bitch 24/7 about top game lists, top 100 game lists from, you know, IGN, or top game lists from Joystick, or top game lists from wherever. And all we do is piss and whine about it. You know, I've been called out on several times. Well, then you make the best top 100 game list, and you show us what we're supposed to be looking at as the top 100. And unfortunately, and we've talked about this in the past, it's not possible. If you take 10,000, I mean, look at movies. trying to come up with 100 of the best movies ever can't really be done. You can go to Internet Movie Database right now and look at their top 250 movies. Some of them are going to hit home with you, and some of them are not going to hit home with you. Casablanca? Is that like everybody listening to the sound of my voice? Is that a top 100 movie of all time? I don't think so. You know, are we talking about best-selling games? Are we talking about, you know, what are we talking about? How are we gauging the rating? So anyway, here is a forum thread, many, many pages, started at Retro Gamer forums, where they're trying to come up with a community-driven top 100 list. And currently they have up to 51. Let's see. Oh, I guess they've got it further down here. I guess they've got it going down to 39. So let's take a look at on the 10 increments what they've rated. Hero on the Atari 2600 comes in at 100. The Sentinel Commodore 64 version comes in at number 90. Number 80, Final Fantasy VIII for the PlayStation. Number 70, Nights into Dreams on the Saturn. 60, Aperion on the Macintosh. Number 50, Sam & Max Hit the Road, PC. Number 40, F-Zero X on the N64. And it just goes on and on. So you might want to jump in and get down with this forum if this is the sort of thing you're looking for. And they're trying to build this list. I don't know. It's an impossible task to come up with the top 100. Now, if you'd like me to come up with the top 100 games of a certain era, if you want me to come up with the top 10 100 arcade games, you know, based on, you know, what I talk about in terms of innovation and, you know, replayability, things like that, that's possible. Don't just say, okay, come up with 100 of the best games. Well, come on. You're talking about spanning like 20, at least 20 major platforms and what, 30 years of video gaming? Come on. But anyway, at least these guys are trying something different, and I kind of like that. It gives you a chance to get interactive with the top 100 list other than reading what, you know, Joe Editor, you know, in Cubicle 7, you know, liked on the NES. Whatever. Anyway, interesting. Normally when I give you guys a piece of information, I like to talk about it and, you know, tell you what it is. In this case, I want you to pause the show, go down to the link that says, I don't know what it's going to say because I haven't edited the links yet, an amusing, I don't know what I'm going to call it, sweet loving video. That's what I'm going to end up calling it. I want you guys to just watch it without knowing what it is, because frankly, it's a lot more fun if you don't know what it is. Funny stuff. Anyway, I'll leave it at that. Sweet loving video. Just pause the show, go watch that, and don't bail out. I know what you're going to think. What the hell is this? Just follow along. I guarantee you'll think it's funny. I thought it was a riot. A lot of people talk, they were talking until the Nintendo DS started kicking everybody's ass. They were talking about, you know, Nintendo's failures. We all hear about, you know, the success stories, and we all know that almost every company has something that they're ashamed of. Anyway, Nintendo's shame was the Virtual Boy, the 3D-ish, eye holographic, whatever the hell it was really supposed to be. You were supposed to put this thing on your desk, look in it like a ViewMaster, and play games in sort of a vector-looking 3D thing. I've actually rarely had an opportunity. I think I've gotten to use it like once. Anyway, Virtual Boy has a good history, of course, behind it. And so you'll want to go check this article out called The Virtual Failure, A Look Back at the Virtual Boy, just to see that Nintendo didn't always do things right. Well, we all know that they didn't always do things right, but it's nice every now and then to have some of the backstory. Well, this is the backstory. A lot of people comment on my concept of Generation Gimme, and somehow the term has managed to get fairly widely adopted, at least within my listener base, and people who know people in my listener base. Generation Gimme seems to be a recognized moniker. However, it doesn't always get called that. And while we always speak of every generation hates the one after it, let's be honest, Generation Gimme is definitely a unique brand of individuals. But we've had numerous coverage of Generation Gimme playing old games and making fun of them and all that stuff. This is pretty funny. You know the Atari 10-in-1 joystick, which it's a jack standard. So, you know, but I don't know how else to put it. But anyway, this is a review made by Generation Gimme about the Atari 10-in-1 joystick. And this is some good reading right here. I'll give you a little bit of it. Nah, this is good stuff. Anyway, this is supposed to be like an actual review. I might just have to read this whole thing. There's so much fun in here. Let me see. Overall, it cannot compete with the present console market in terms of gaming experience and has a number of shortcomings, including touchy controls, a limited software library, and insufficient multiplayer support. You know, this guy shouldn't have even gotten to write this stuff. This is crazy. This is so funny. Definitely not a 360 killer. Dude, you just bought a package off of Walmart's shelf for $14 that has an Atari 2600 joystick in it that clearly outlines 10 games. I don't see any network port on it. And this is just way too much fun. The unit comes with everything completely intact. Everything you need to play is in one piece. The reset, select, and start buttons are integrated into the base, as well as power switch and red power LED. Video and mono audio cable are also permanently attached to the base. The system is powered by 4 AAAs, which are inserted. Other than that, this has the same nostalgic ergonomics of the original Atari joystick, horrible though it may be. Okay. Love this. The unit includes 10 games that the maker described as classic. Classic or no, I must admit the games were nothing like I'd ever played before. The unit takes a few seconds to boot up when the power switch is turned on, then a splash screen followed by a selection menu with all 10 games. You select the games using the joystick. Once the game is selected, the user is presented with a short synopsis of the game and instructions. Pressing the lone fire button, because one fire button is not enough, got to have 15, skips past this screen to start the game. Once in the game, the user must start the game in the same way as the original 2600, either press start to begin or select button to toggle through different gameplays. Once your mode is selected, pressing start starts the game. Okay. All games are controlled using the A-Way joystick, replaced in today's consoles by the D-pad. Yeah, right. And a single red fire button. The fire button feels very clicky, and the joystick responds with a little pressure in each direction. You don't actually feel the stick move. It feels rather stiff, but responds well. The pressure and leverage of the stick make the base want to tilt, so the player should have a death grip on the base if they don't want this, quote, console, unquote, to come flying off in their hands. I mean, it's funny when you get a different perspective on things, you know? It's hard for us to imagine being old people, what it's like to get a hold of old technology. But, you know, I think that, you know, the generation that we are currently engaged in has no real respect for what came before. And I think that's part of the big problem. I know, because I, like, hung out with my grandparents, I know some of the things that my grandparents had to go through. Waiting for your TV to warm up. I mean, dude, let's think about that for a minute. There was a time, probably before most of us were born, but there was a time when you turned on the TV and you went and got a sandwich, waiting for the tubes to warm up, right? I can respect that. I don't have to say TV sucked because it took 20 minutes for the TV to boot. You know, there's a difference between what we look back in retrospect as to what Generation Gimme comes back in retrospect, which is really too bad. But let me continue with this, because this guy's got some more things to say. Let me see. I'm trying to find. There's some really good stuff. Did you know that Adventure was a forerunner for his favorite game, Doom 3? Yeah, Adventure is the prequel to Doom 3. That's right. He mentions Breakout as being that the controller's non-precision, making it a bad experience. Well, yeah, because, I mean, if you're going to smack the game around, that's cool. Breakout should never be played with a joystick. Mouse at worst, spinner with best. But, you know, maybe the guy doesn't know about it. He does like to make mention of new things like the Matrix. The touchy joystick makes it all too possible to Matrix, in quotes, around the ball and completely dodge it. Yeah, this is funny. I mean, you got to read some of this stuff. I could spend all day talking about this. Let's see. This is funny. Missile Command. I got to read the whole thing on Missile Command. Missile Command is an extraordinarily epic, spectacular human drama set upon the doomed landscape of humanity's future. Wow, talk about reading into it. It's also one of the more enjoyable games in this set, despite the fact that he just complained that, you know, you can't play Breakout with a joystick. Whatever. You fire a cannon thing at bomb things that are falling down on your town things. It's surprisingly cinematic, and the explosions of your poor settlements look cool. I shed a tear when I completely lost one of them. All in all, it's not a very optimistic game. It could have easily been called Doom if that game wasn't taken more than a decade earlier. I don't know. Anyway, you got to read through this. It's like 3 pages, and it's almost all pure gold. But I can't get enough of stuff like that. I don't know. I weep for the future. That's it. Right from Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Remember a little while ago we just talked about how MAME was being put on iPods? Somebody decided to make a MAME cabinet out of an iPod. But it's not quite what you're thinking. I have to give the guy just a little tiny bit of credit. The fact that it's got an iPod in it pisses me off, but the fact that, you know, this is actually pretty cool. You remember those little tiny cabinet reproductions that remember those little ones that we used to see, the ColecoVision, or not ColecoVision, but the Coleco ones, the Donkey Kong, the Pac-Man, those ones? Well, those are still huge collector's items, by the way. This guy made a small actual arcade scale model of a Ms. Pac-Man machine that you could slide your iPod into sideways and play Ms. Pac-Man on a magnified screen. The guy gets like 10 points for creativity. I mean, this isn't like, it's kind of like making your Game Boy into a web server, kind of. But this has something kind of clever behind it. In any event, it's a shame that it's an iPod he's putting in it, but, you know, whatever. We gotta cater to the current generation, right? At least they're playing Ms. Pac-Man on it. What can I tell you? Okay, let's plod through these. We've already almost done an hour, and I'm not even close to being done. Seems that Marble Madness has been quite the clonable game as of late, with games like Hamster Ball and all sorts of other titles borrowing from the mechanics. Here is a shameless version of it, which I haven't had a chance to play yet, but I'll pass it along, called Rolling Madness 3D. It is a giant extended version of Marble Madness. OpenGL, SDL style creation, FMOD, so this thing's ported to pretty much everything. Definitely worth taking a look at. I'm a big slut for Marble Madness, so eventually I'll get around to it. It's got a 6th level world right now, and the levels look pretty huge, so you got some time to play. But anyway, I think it's funny that games kind of go through trends in terms of, you know, who's copying what. Interesting. Here is a new, I've never seen shortflip.com. This is the online magazine for men, which is probably why I haven't seen it. Testosterone-driven periodicals. Anyway, this is the top 10 most violent video games as seen by Shortflip, the online magazine for men. You want to know what the top 10 most violent video games are? I'm going to hook you up, because we're going to go through them all right now. Number 10, Hitman Contracts, which honestly I've never played, so I can't really comment on it. Number 9, Resident Evil. Yeah, I go with that. There's some pretty gory crap in there. Doom 3 is number 8. Number 7, Silent Hill series. They don't mention them, you know, by name. Mortal Kombat Deception. Carmageddon 2 clocks in number 5. Number 4 is Blood Rain. Number 3, Soldier of Fortune 2. Have the stuff I haven't played. Grand Theft Auto Vice City. You know what's funny, though? It looks like the picture that they put with Vice City is actually of San Andreas. I don't know why people do that. And number 1 on the list is Postal 2. And I got to admit, you know, Postal 2 is a first-person shooter, but I'll tell you, any game that you can, like, piss on people, you got to give it some props. Let me tell you, let me read to you what the guy wrote. Postal 2 Apocalypse Weekend. If you're looking for pure brutality, you found it. The outstanding graphics make the senseless slaughter of innocent people quite an experience. Use a shovel to decapitate a person and kick the head around like a soccer ball. Launch a victim onto a spiny cactus. Sledgehammer heads that burst like squashed grapes. Kill cats, dogs, cows, elephants, and murder an endless horde of hippies out for a good time. Taser an innocent until he's a quivering mess. You can even urinate on people and use a cat as a silencer for your gun. Man, I totally forgot about that. Douse people with gasoline and ignite the body. If you press K on your keyboard, your character will shove a hand grenade into his mouth and say, "I regret nothing," just before the explosion. As far as violent video games go, this one takes the cake. But you know, you never hear about Postal 2. You hear about Grand Theft Auto. It's funny. We have a fickle media. Okay, so what else do we have here? Man. Okay. I swear, folks, I'm running it down. This next item is definitely outside the scope of our regular stuff, but I like to speak a lot about how we're being trounced on by our government and how our rights are being violated. And somebody recommended this to my listeners. Again, not video game oriented, but apparently there's a video series called from suppressedmedia.com. And I know I'll spend like all frickin' day if I get started with this. It has many videos such as the 9/11, the greatest lie ever told. This really starts bordering into politics, so I don't want to bring politics into this show at all. It's bad enough we have it on the forums. But anyway, this video number 7 on this list, you can download them for free. It's called David, I'm assuming it's Icky? Man, there's no translation here. Secrets of the Matrix. And according to the submitter, this is good stuff that'll really show how civil liberties are being trampled upon. Haven't seen it, but it came in. Thought, hey, we'll share with my listeners. AtariAge.com has for sale video game collector edition number 5. Video Game Collector magazine caters to classic and modern game enthusiasts, including a complete price guide and checklist for every major video game system for the Atari 2600 through the Xbox. Inside, you'll also find original editorial content written by respected members of the gaming community, interviews, giveaways, reviews of classic video games, and the video game industry's largest and most up-to-date checklist and price guide. The 5th issue, spring of 2006, features a Dragon's Lair interview, of course, which is why it got sent to me. There's a Twin Galaxy scoreboard. There's a special report on the Nintendo e-reader. Confessions of the Game Doctor, which has some excerpts from his new book, Bill Kunkel. We've had him on the show a couple times. Great, great guest. We got to get him back in and see what he's up to. Some video game reviews of Electroplankton, It's Only Rock and Roll for the ColecoVision, Super Gunstar Heroes, which is a great game for the GBA. Looks pretty good. Issue $6. You know, I should probably pick one of those up or see if they'll comp me one that I can talk about on the show. If you work for Atari Age, and I know there's people who listen to the show that do, why don't you guys shoot me over one of these things so I can take a look at it and talk about it? It's hard for me to remember to buy stuff. Vintage Computer Festival, May 13th at the Info Age Learning Center in Wall Township, New Jersey. Third annual Vintage Computer Festival will be held on Saturday, May 13th. Doors open at 9:30 a.m. Event ends at 6 p.m. Admission's $10 per person. Parking is free. This is sort of a, from what I see here, looks like a kind of computer-centric CGE type thing. I haven't been to it. If anybody has been to it, I recommend talking about it on our forums, mentioning it, sell your old computer stuff, show off your computer, set up a booth to exhibit. Let's see, who were the sponsors of this guy? Anybody we know? A bunch of local stuff. The X Game Station, our buddy Andre Lamont over there. He's a sponsor for that. I'm trying to see if there's anybody else we know here. Looks like mostly local folks. But hey, if you're in New Jersey, specifically Wall Township, New Jersey, and you're looking for some festival to visit, this looks pretty good. It even has the page in like 7 different languages. So, hey, you know, no matter what you speak, you're good to go. Once again, somebody has far too much time on their hands. We have built a CD player with an old Game Boy and a Tappy drive and some electronics. You know what? I'm not even going to go into this. I'll give you guys a link. For those of you who are dying to see a Game Boy turn into a CD player, there you go. Alrighty then. Video Game Voters Network. Okay. Then let me just read you their opening paragraph. The Video Game Voters Network exists to empower Americans who play video games to take action against threats to this entertainment medium and to stay informed about the latest issues that could affect our choice in video game entertainment. Video games are a modern form of entertainment entitled to the same creative and free speech protections afforded by the U.S. Constitution to older media such as movies, music, and books. So join the Video Game Voters Network and speak up for games and gamers' rights. It looks like a pretty decent deal. Someone's trying to get some action done. Hey, better than sitting and bitching about it, all right? Now, I'll tell you what bugs me the most, you know, and this is just me. This is off on a tangent. Will Wright has endorsed this site. The guy who made SimCity, Sims. Anyway, the thing that bugs me the most is, maybe this is just me. I've talked about this before, but remember I used to talk in the old days, back when I had nothing better to talk about how forced political correctness really draws attention to itself? When you attempt to be representative and you do it in a manner that is overboard, it becomes no longer seamless. Let me tell you what I'm talking about. And this is another tangent thing, but you know, you guys like to listen to me drone sometimes. Have you ever been to a website, a business website, a corporate stiff website? You'll notice that every picture is carefully chosen. Very, very carefully chosen to ensure complete diversity. Race, creed, religion, gender, you name it. They make sure that every possible angle is covered. If you remember installing Windows 98, I think it was, 98 SE? One of the 98s made sure that, you know, they used to have graphics when it would install. And they would show you pictures of people getting ready to enjoy Windows XP. And it's like there's a checklist that you have to follow. Okay, I got myself a Caucasian male, aged white female. I got an Oriental young guy. I've got a black guy in a wheelchair. It's like there's a checklist of everybody that you have to include on something in order for you not to get sued or not to look like the bad guy. Well, if you watch the Flash animation of this Video Game Voters Network, it is. It's like checkbox. There's the black guy. There's the Asian guy. Well, who's next? We got the young Caucasian woman. Could be Latino. It's hard to tell. Who else do we got here? Oh, there we go. We got the young, YM14. Oh, there's another. That looks like maybe a Mexican guy. Oh, there's our older woman. You just got to watch this stuff. This stuff jumps out at me. You know, they're supposed to be doing this to show some sort of non-preferential. It's like a affirmative action. I don't know. Enough bitching about politics. This is what I'm talking about. When you go out of your way to do this. When you go out of the way to select only the people from your company that show a great racial diversity and take their picture for the internet, you're not showing racial diversity. You're showing... never mind. I don't want to get into this. This is more politics trap. But anyway, I do applaud these guys, aside from the fact that they've got some political correct checklist that they made for... Oh, by the way, they're floating in front of the American flag, too. It's got to get that cheerleader thing in. Never mind. Anyway, so I'm glad somebody's trying to do something. You know, they mention like the real right folks, the Hillary Clintons and the Joe Liebermans, and how they're trying to basically eliminate, you know, video gaming in general. But anyway, it's a good source if you want to keep up to date on what's going on in our nation. It's not going to stop most people anyway, but I'm glad somebody's trying to do something. Shigeru Miyamoto was just given an award over in France, the Order of Arts and Letters. This is the first time electronic game artists have achieved France's highest award for culture. The cultural minister, oh man, I hope there's no French people listening, Renaud Denudeux de Vabres, honored three game creators on Monday. Nintendo's Shigeru Miyamoto Ubisoft's Michael Ancel and Frederick Reynal. Hope I got that right. Director of the original Alone in the Dark game. Two French guys and Miyamoto, one of Japan's most famous video creators, of course. Video game creators, you know, he's the guy that made, like, Donkey Kong, right? Super Mario Brothers, et cetera, et cetera. You know, like the number one guy. So anyway, nice to see somebody in other countries getting some, you know, giving some awards away for people who have basically changed the face of video gaming. Love to see credit where credit's due. All right. What do we got up next here? Whew. Man. Here are some interesting pictures here. There's no website. This is pretty straightforward stuff. These are some design documents that were originally created for the Tron video game. These look like they were scanned right out of a, you know, right out of a pamphlet. You know, some, well, not a pamphlet, but a design document. So this is kind of cool. They have, it's got a bunch of movie tie-in stuff. It talks about, it's got a document that deals with manufacturing and distribution collaboration between Disney and Bally Midway. This is kind of cool stuff. This is like, you know, it's like those secret Nazi letters from the back line. I mean, these aren't bad or anything. I don't mean to make a negative connotation there, but it's like, you know, sometimes you get to see the secret stuff, and it's kind of cool. Anyway, this is kind of like secret stuff, so it's kind of cool to see that. This is interesting. Remember we talked about Star ROMs, I don't know how many shows ago. Flair helped me out here. Star ROMs was supposedly, and nobody managed to prove one way or the other, a legal distribution of ROM images that you would pay, you know, I can't remember what the dollar amount was, but Star ROMs would let you buy, apparently legally, ROMs, Atari ROMs to play on emulators. Well, they're gone. And in fact, right now, their site's not even coming up. I do remember when I previewed these links for the show that it was working, and I can't remember why they're actually leaving, but the domain's even gone, so they left quick. If anybody has an actual story behind what happened there, I'd love to hear it. I'd love to hear that it turned out that they were actually illegally selling the stuff, and we just, you know, never knew about it. Every now and then I get sent links to some shareware stuff, and I haven't even come close to having a chance to look at this. This is a game called Feelers. Yeah. Ready, aim, fireflies. Evil insect forces have kidnapped your colony's queen, spelling doom for your collective. Unless you can protect its few remaining eggs, the embryos will eventually hatch into new queens if you can mow down the hordes of creepy crawlies. 13 power-ups, 14 different enemies, 39 levels, explosive audio. It's kind of got a classic game look to it. So, you know, sometimes it's nice to have some nice family-friendly type games. I don't know if fireflies blasting each other is actually family entertainment, but it's nice. I like to support the independent developers every now and then and mention a game. I haven't played it, but, you know, if that game sounds interesting to you, well, there you go. Okay, let me see what else we got here. Another entry into the Shane Hates Microsoft catalog. Microsoft to ship Linux. This is pretty good. This is an old page, of course, but you know, every now and then, you just got to share some of the old stuff, like I said earlier. MS Linux shipping November 2003. That shows how old the site is. But they've managed to like swipe every style sheet and completely duplicate the style of Microsoft's website at the time. This is great. Microsoft Linux provides all the power of the Linux operating system with the ease of use you've come to expect with Microsoft products. Brings a whole new level of productivity to Linux without sacrificing flexibility, performance, and control. In addition to features like My Home Directory and My Configuration, Microsoft Linux contains greatly improved support for web and enterprise development. With Microsoft Linux Enterprise Edition, you can create scalable multi-tier application using our new graphical user interface command line technology, aka GILT. Extend your productivity with optimized support for Internet ActiveX Windows technology and built-in Internet Explorer web browser. This, again, this is like pure gold stuff. You just have to go through there. And you must read on the left-hand side. This is easy to miss. there's a little what others are saying box. You absolutely have to read those five or six quotes there. That's good stuff. That's good stuff. Just good reading. Remember the old 2600 combat game? I know, endlessly duplicated. You know, it's old news. Well, somebody has come up with like these little remote control tanks. I had to actually watch the movie to get a good grasp on what the hell they were talking about. Interesting concept. Apparently, when you like duel with these things, if you shoot the enemy tank, it electrocutes the guy with the other remote. Now, this could be like a farce or something. I don't know. I mean, I've seen weirder things, but definitely check it out. Shocking tanks. I don't know, man. I've never understood the concept of deliberately shooting yourself up with electricity. But hey, you know, what do I know? I don't know how to have fun, right? I don't watch Jackass, so I don't, you know, I don't know what to do with that sort of thing. Okay, well, we're almost done here, folks. We're almost wrapped up the news. Have you ever wondered just how many bathrooms in video games, how many toilets in video games actually work? Well, these guys have come up with the video game toilets and bathroom pictures. This is basically them showing you all the different commodes, and those of some of them actually you could use inside of video games, both old and new, including games like, of course, Grand Theft Auto, Hitman, Alone in the Dark, Carmageddon, which was actually pretty fun. You could just totally wipe out bathrooms in that. Blood 2. Anyway, so there you go. How many toilets can you recognize? And their little subheading is, it's great when video games let you use the toilet, eh? Yes, it is actually kind of good. I always thought that was kind of cool. Oh, the grand list of console role-playing game cliches. There are a few people who love a good console RPG more than I. Games like Final Fantasy, Grandia, Skies of Arcadia set a standard of majesty and wonders and immersion that American game designers struggle and usually fail to match. Yet as I play the latest masterpiece to come out of Japan, I can't somehow feel like thinking somehow I've seen it all before. Warning, there are spoilers in here for many popular RPGs. Anyway, this is funny. They go through and talk about cliches that are usually inside of RPG games. Now, some of these I understand because I did play some RPGs. Obviously, a lot of these I don't understand. But here we go. Let's look at some of these because some of these are actually pretty funny. The sleepyhead rule. The teenage male lead will begin the first day of the game by oversleeping, being awoken by his mother, and being reminded that he slept in so late he's meeting his girlfriend. The Logan's Run rule. RPG characters are young, very young. The average age seems to be 15 unless the character is a decorated and battle-hardened soldier, in which case he might even be as old as 18. Such teenagers often have skills with multiple weapons and magic, years of experience, and never worry about their parents telling them to come home from adventuring before bedtime. By contrast, characters more than 22 years old will cheerfully refer to themselves as washed-up old fogies and be eager to make room for the younger generation. Poor little rich hero. If the hero comes from a rich and powerful family, it will have fallen on hard times and be broken destitute by the time the game actually starts. These are some, you know, the three obligatory party members that you'll gain. What are some of the other things? Nod your head and smile. MacGyver rule. Your choice of weapons is not limited to prosaic guns, clubs, and swords. Given appropriate skills, you can cut a bloody swath across the continent using gloves, combs, umbrellas, megaphones, dictionaries, sketching tablets, you name it, you can kill with it. Nothing wrong with that. Let's see. Anyway, there's tons of this stuff. Let me see how many there actually are on here. This guy's busy. 192 cliches. Did you know there were 192 cliches inside RPGs? Well, there you go. Yeah, actually kind of a fun list to look at. I like that. Here's a new one that just hit my computer here today. Video games tackle lazy eye. Playing virtual reality computer games can help the treatment treat the condition known as amblyopia. Or lazy eye. There you go. Lazy eye. That's better. Say researchers. In patients with amblyopia, there's got to be a doctor on here to pronounce this for me. One eye works better than the other. Because the eye is inferior for some reason, the brain decides to use the good eye. Over time, the neural connections to the bad eye becomes gradually weaker in favor of the good eye. No mention of Shannon Doherty in here at all? Man, what's that all about? Anyway, so they're saying that you can fix a lazy eye with video games. Yeah. Who am I to judge, right? I'm not a doctor. I don't know any of this stuff. Well, folks, I've prattled on a whole good hour here, and we got tons more show for you. Hope you enjoyed Bits and Bytes. Remember, these come from you guys. You guys send these in. Go to RetroGamingRadio.com, click on the Submit a News, and send us what you think might be newsworthy. We don't look at everything. Some things may be out of context for the show, or I'm just too lazy, or they may expire, so you may not see them. But as you can see, most of the things end up coming up, and even if they are kind of outside the realm, as long as there's something interesting about them, I'll probably talk about them. So anyway, these are all contributed by you. Thank you so much for everybody who contributed. And we'll see you next month with even more great bits and bytes right here on Retro Gaming Radio. Well, folks, I think that's going to wrap it up for this edition of Retro Gaming Radio. Special thanks go out to Speedhost.com and their affiliate, Zaccum.com, Zaccum.com. The best in free unlimited hosting for your web projects, your web files, Zaccum.com. Big supporter of the show. We really appreciate that. And thanks to Demolition Man, Demo Man, for being our first call-in. Yes, we are going to have more call-ins. This was sort of a test. There will be times and places posted, so to speak. Just stick around to the show. Big thanks to all of our listeners, especially all of our new UK listeners. Compliments of Retro Gamer Magazine. Pick up the latest issue of Retro Gamer Magazine. I've got a review of the GP2X, I believe, in the latest one, as well as my regular column, America Free Retro. Great magazine. Check it out. I think that'll wrap up this edition of Retro Gaming Radio. This is Shane Armand Rose saying, until next time, keep it retro.